Well, thank you very much for coming in. I appreciate it. I love the book. There were some absolutely marvelous stories. There were two stories in The Year of the Hot Jock that are my favorites. One is the one called Bar, 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 which is about the older couple. They get together to go off on gambling junkets.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one I liked especially, that was the one in which the man learned of the death of Johnny Weissmuller and retraced his childhood steps up in the Bronx. Or what?
Right.
He left
Bonnie Berrigan.
Yeah, that was a wonderful story.
Few people that I've talked to about it never heard of Bonnie Berrigan, but that doesn't hurt anything because as you read the story, you figure out who he is. It's always a shock to me that people don't know who Bonnie Berrigan is, but I guess that's my generation.
I guess those people can't get started with you.
Very good, very good.
The can you? I didn't see a common theme among the stories, except that, of course, they were all urban in their orientation. Maybe you can amplify that.
Well, it probably is not a common theme because they. Okay, they
start
were
again.
Sure. It probably is not a common theme because they were written over about a 15-year period. Five of the stories come out of the 60s and the 70s, and four of them were done the last few years. I had a period when I wrote stories like crazy way back when I started, and that culminated in Roar, Lion, Roar, my first collection. Then I got hooked on novels, and I wrote six novels rather quickly. And then suddenly returned to the stories. So I doubt if there is a unifying theme, except the thing that you said. They're all urban, they're all city people, they're all trying to make it in ways that maybe the world thinks is pretty crazy, but perfectly adjusted and adjustable for them.
There's another story I like, too, and I think some of these stories might come out of your position as a school guidance counselor, too, because there are a lot of inner-city youths represented in some of the stories.
No, I've never drawn on my own school experience, believe it or not, except for one story, and that was the title number of Roar, Lion, Roar. I did teach in Harlem many years ago, and I picked up the street talk, and, of course, I used that jargon for the Puerto Rican kid in Roar, Lion, Roar. But none of the stories, except tangentially, have ever dealt with the work that I'm doing, oddly enough.
Well, still, you obviously have an awareness and understanding of some of the needs and problems that young people have, and this does seem to be reflected in some of the stories.
Yeah, well, I think that's a pretty good comment, and I could never deny that much of this sinks into the subconscious and surfaces in my fiction. I don't consciously draw on it, really, is what I want to say.
There was one wonderful story. I guess the child was... I guess you'd consider her an inner-city youth, 5 years old. But that was struck me as so funny, the babblings from her mouth. Was she speaking in tongues? But, I mean, what's wrong with this child? She needs psychiatric help, and here she's parroting her father's comments about athletics and sports. You know, that's really funny because... sports buffs do talk like that,
mm-hmm.
And I have no idea what they're saying. It's absolutely incredible. I have a feeling that you are kind of a sports buff because the opening story, The Year of the Hot Jock, and because you have some affinity for gambling, maybe, Atlantic City. Phil, tell me a little bit about yourself and your own interest when you're not working and writing.
Okay, yeah, you're correct. When I came out of World War II and felt that I should use the GI Bill of Rights, I didn't know what else to do, really. I decided to go back to college, but not as an English major, where I had started out. And not knowing what else to do, I decided on a double major, which was physical education and biology at City College. That sounds, I guess, kind of odd, because one does not major in physical ed at City College. One majors in engineering, or you're Bernard Malamud studying English Lit, or whatever. But that's what I did. I was a fairly capable jock in those days. I could, we called it the broad jump. Today they call it the long jump. I could broad jump about 20 feet. I could probably run the 100 around 10-8, if these numbers mean anything to you. I even fiddled around with the pole vault. I began in education that way, but then I soon got out of it and moved over into the guidance, counseling, and psychology area. In fact, I got my, I was well on my way to my doctorate at Columbia before I realized I could write. At which point I was about 30 years old. I didn't publish a story till I was about 31. I had a marvelous advisor up at Columbia Teachers College who said, hey, I think you can write. I think we can put a thesis together. We might even get it published by the college, which was news to me, really. But he was right. They did publish it, and I guess I got interested in jumping from case studies, which I had been doing, into fiction. So I sat down and wrote a short story, which I showed to my wife, who's my best critic. And if she says something's pretty good, I usually go by that. And she said, that was good. And my reaction was, well, I've written a story. We both like it. What do I do with it? I had no idea what you do with a short story. So somebody told me to get hold of one of the short story anthologies, like the O. Henry Awards and so on, because in the back of the book there's a list of addresses of magazines. So I did the usual. I started sending the thing out, and I got about 20 rejection slips, and the 21st, which was the Carlton Miscellany, the magazine of Carlton College in Minnesota, took it. Then as the usual, it was picked up and anthologized, that kind of thing. I wrote a few more stories that were placed in esoteric journals. Then I wrote a story that the Paris Review picked up with George Plimpton, who seems to know everybody in the world. And before I knew it, I was getting letters from publishers. It seems that a lot of writers are discovered through the mail that way. The gist of most of the letters was that we either read your stories or heard about them, and we're very interested in you as a writer. Do you have a novel? Well, I didn't have a novel, and I didn't have too many stories at that point, and they always would tell me to come back when I had a novel. A gentleman named Bob Loomis at Random House wrote me one of those letters, and I said the same thing. And by that time, I'd had about 10 stories, and I told him I did. He said, well, let's take a look at them. I sent them over to Random House. He looked at them and rejected them. I said, okay, fine. About 6 weeks later, I got another letter from Loomis saying, I can't get your stories out of my head. I've talked to Mr. Cerf, Bennett Cerf, and we'd like to do them. And that's how it all began.
Well, second life for those stories.
Yeah.
You went on from the story collection to a novel. It was called The Steagle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tell me about how that novel came about.
Well, I was beginning to think that, like Salinger's famous statement describing himself, that I was a sprinter and not a miler, and could only write stories, which is perfectly okay. But then in 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis hit, and it triggered something. Instead of a reaction of fear and loathing, my fictive mind began to think of a kind of a liberating thing. I mean, if the world's going to end in about a week because Kennedy and Khrushchev are going to push the button, why not have a great time? Why not live out all the fantasies you've stored up for 40 years? And so I invented my college prof, who took off across the country and indeed lived out all his fantasies for a week, had a great time, until his consternation that the missile crisis was over and he had to return. I've often thought of doing a sequel to it, but nothing has ever since then quite approached the missile crisis in terms of our reaction formations. The Stiegel was ultimately made into a movie. It's probably the most unsuccessful movie of all time.
Oh, who was in that?
Richard Benjamin.
Mm-hmm.
And the original cut was pretty good. It was a good movie. But then the money people, the people who actually have the right of final cut, decided that the movie was offensive to Jews, Catholics, and stewardesses.
And Cubans.
No, I didn't worry too much about Cubans. I think he worried more about stewardesses, and not necessarily in that order. So we began to cut it, and then when I saw it in commercial release, it made very little sense. Every now and then it surfaces on the TV late show. You might pick it up 3 o'clock in the morning. The director, a guy named Paul Silbert, who wrote a dandy screenplay, I thought, wrote a book about it, which, interestingly enough, was called Final Cut, and I believe there's a book around now that has the same title. But he describes the trauma of this movie, and names names and events and dates, and today it's almost as difficult a book to find as The Stiegel.
That's interesting. That's reminiscent of Leonard Sanders. Did I have it right? Leonard Sanders? Wrote the,
you got me.
Oh, now you know his stuff. It's he wrote The First Deadly Sin.
Oh, Lawrence Sanders.
Lawrence Sanders.
Yeah.
The First Deadly Sin. And several other deadly sins followed that. But his movie, The First Deadly Sin, was made into a motion picture with Frank Sinatra and Faye Dunaway. I don't know if you saw it. If you didn't see it, you were lucky.
No, I didn't.
I thought the First Deadly Sin was one of the best mystery novels I'd ever read. And they absolutely destroyed it by putting it on film. They didn't. They ruined his plot. And in fact, it got such bad reviews that the movie was in the theaters for about a week, 2 weeks, and then they shelved it. But why would they take a movie like that and just ruin it? I mean, take a book that was good, that was had all the makings for a good movie, and just kill it.
Same question I ask myself, why do that? But there seems to be a lemming instinct in Hollywood that's unexplainable. And they constantly do things like this. Some of my other friends say, well, just don't go to see the movie. But
it's your story.
Right, of course.
It's your creation up there that's being blown.
Right.
You, all during the time that you were writing in the 60s and 70s and now the 80s, you were working in education.
Uh-huh.
Did you have any, or have you had any difficulty in reconciling this full-time job with your job? It almost seems like a full-time job as a writer.
Yeah. No, I really haven't. As a matter of fact, I think it's made me a better writer, and being a writer has made me a better counselor. I fully subscribe to the theory that writers dry up by staring at their navel for 18 hours a day, and some of our best writers have done that. The European method of being involved in some way, Chekhov was a doctor, Malraux was a political activist, whatever, and then writing seems to be a nurturing kind of experience which keeps the pipes flowing. And in 20 years, I've knocked out 8 books. Now, that may not be as prolific as some people around, but it's not bad. It's a book every 2.5 years or so. And I'm sure I couldn't have done that if I was a full-time writer. Because when I come home at night, my head is clear for the world of fiction. And I can really go. And when an idea strikes, I go like a streak. Luckily, I'm married to a girl who understands that kind of thing and can live with it.
Are you telling me that when you get home after a full day at work, you're not exhausted and all you want to do is take it easy and put your feet up and watch some TV?
I often am. But if I've got one of these ideas cooking, It revives me, and before I know it, I'm sailing right along. So I'm convinced that being tired in the way that you describe is not a real fatigue. It's more like a battle fatigue, neurasthenia, whatever. And I get recharged the minute I start thinking about my characters and what happens to them.
Of course, working in education, you probably have longer periods between times that you actually physically have to be at the school. Isn't that true? You have long summer vacations and long winter vacations.
Yeah, I get 2 months off in the summer, and I get things like Christmas and Easter. But oddly enough, I do very little writing in the summer. I'm not terribly productive. I wrote a big chunk of the Stiegel a number of summers ago, but other than that, I haven't done terribly much in the summer. I seem to do it all under the pressure cooker of my job, which tells me I've got to organize and discipline myself, and somehow it works. And I can only say that for me it works. I would tend to recommend this to a lot of young writers who decide that all they want to do is hole up in a garret and write all day, because I think you have to have an involvement. I think you have to be in some part of the world, and I don't think that world should be teaching writing or teaching creative writing or fiction, which I've done or tried to do. It's a very difficult thing to do. I'm not sure anybody can do it. But living an entirely different life, I think, is a marvelous way for a writer to produce. And all I can say, to circle back to my point, is that it works for me.
Yeah, I've always wondered about writers who decide to go up to some cabin in the mountains and stay there perpetually and do all the writing up there. It seems to me like it's almost like putting a sheet around them so they can't see anything around
mm-hmm.
them.
I agree with that.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Some of our best writers, I think, have dried up and have become so involuted and convoluted that all they can do is keep repeating. Now, I suppose people can accuse me of the same thing. But I do try to stretch out, and if you read any of my stuff, you know I fiddle around with historical themes and the interplay and counterpoint of history plus the present day and so on, the Spanish-American War, the Boxer Rebellion, that type of thing. So I suppose the guidance counselor in me is now saying to young writers out there, live a little before you write and keep on living.
But Faust, let me take you back a little further. You grew up in New York City.
Yes.
Where? Bronx?
I was born in Brooklyn, lived in Queens for a while, joined the Army, and when I came back, I have lived in Manhattan ever since.
Mm-hmm. When you were growing up in Brooklyn and in Queens, you indicated a moment ago there was a lot of the jock in you. Was there any indication, as you were a jock in the streets and on the playgrounds and at school, this sort of thing, that you might be a writer at some point? You had an awareness in college, but prior to college, mm-hmm. did you have any inkling that this might happen to you?
Yes. In my senior year in high school, for some reason, I got the itch to join the school newspaper. I was in a Queens school called Newtown High School, and they had a newspaper called the X-Ray. And I joined the sports staff, and I remember covering basketball and baseball games or whatever. I had a lot of fun doing it, but didn't get any particular notice or recognition or any ideas that this would lead to anything until the sports editor of the paper, I still remember his name. His name was Don Marks, who wrote a column called Marks Remarks. I can still recall that. He said, Irv, you got to be a sports writer someday. You're the next John Lardner. John Lardner was our hero, by the way. Not Ring Lardner, not Runyon, not Grantland Rice. John Lardner was a fantastic sports writer. Died young, just as his father did, but in my more mature judgment, was even a better writer than Ring. Outside of that, no, I really didn't think much about becoming a writer. But Don Marks, I suppose, spotted something.
When you were at college and you developed what became a thesis that was published, what was that about?
This was in graduate school, mm-hmm. remember. This was at Columbia Teachers. And I had written, I was teaching in Harlem at the time, and I wrote a term paper about my experience in Harlem. And as I was going for my master's in guidance and counseling, because it was very difficult to reach kids who barely spoke English or had all kinds of the types of problems we read about today, I got into the counseling field and was working towards a master's and was toying around with the idea of a doctorate. And this very perceptive advisor said, I know it's always difficult to get hold of a thesis or a paper for your doctorate, but I think we've got the germ of an idea here. You just wrote about your experience in Harlem. Let's develop a book of case studies told from the standpoint of the student. He said, my reaction to that was, well, how can I ever get that by a committee who wants some kind of experimental thing, you know, pre-testing, post-testing, the usual kind of educational jargon and so on. He said, well, that's my job, and let's see if I can get them to do it. It might be unorthodox enough to intrigue them. And sure enough, it was, and it did. And they accepted it. I got my doctorate, and they went ahead and published it.
What did you do in the war?
I was in the Signal Corps in the in Patton's Third Army, 65th Division. We went across France, Germany, Austria, hooked up with the Russians in Linz, Hitler's birthplace, incidentally, which I thought was poetic justice because just about that time I got a telegram that my father had died, which is the kind of thing that seems to happen to writers. I mean, soldiers are supposed to be killed. Their fathers back home don't die, but that's the way it happened in my case. By the time everything was put into some kind of processing machine so that I might get back via the Red Cross, it never occurred, and the next thing I knew I was on a boat heading for the Philippines and the tail end of the Philippine campaign. So I'm probably the only guy who served under Patton and MacArthur. And then we went into Japan in the Army of Occupation. Like all of my generation, it was the watershed event of our lives. In fact, my last novel, Newsreel, deals with a man who takes 22 years to readjust. And I'm not so sure he's ever readjusted, even today.
You are currently living in Manhattan, is that correct?
Yes.
And you're working on Long Island?
Right. Uh-huh. I commute in the opposite direction.
How is that?
It used to be good. It used to be great. You'd beat the traffic. You could kind of laugh at the people coming into the city on this wall-to-wall Grand Central Parkway. But lately it's gotten a little rough, and what used to be a 45-minute trip is stretched out to over an hour. I'm hanging tough. And at this point, Morningside Heights has been my turf for so many years, and my involvement with Columbia and Columbia people, I don't know if I could make the break, but...
That's where you live in Morningside Heights?
Right, yeah. Maybe I will make the break one of these days. I don't know.
You mean to go to Long Island?
Yeah, no, yeah.
That's like putting the sheet around. The
That's what everybody tells me.
Why don't you work in Manhattan, and then you can walk to work?
Well, as I said, when I first got into the teaching game, I worked in Harlem. But then when I moved over into guidance and counseling, they weren't hiring counselors. Of all the places in the world that needs counseling help, the New York City Public School needed it desperately. But in a very catch-22 way, they decided they weren't going to hire these people. And there I was... with a license to teach physical ed, but with a master's, and on my way to a doctorate in the field that I really wanted, with no prospects of a job. So my wife and I sat down and talked it over and decided I had to look around where the jobs were. That meant New Jersey, Westchester, Nassau, and I landed in Nassau County.
You know, you are a rarity because most of the writers that I talk to usually have some link to higher education in terms of academics. Usually they teach creative writing or they teach English or this sort of thing. And you have kind of a, I would assume, a rough and tumble, nitty gritty day job. And that's kind of unusual in a way, because there are very few full-time writers. Almost everybody has to link his or her passion for writing with a job that actually pays something. So it's kind of unusual. Occasionally you find somebody who, like Louis Auchincloss, who's a lawyer, but most of the writers seem to be very academic and nestle themselves on campuses someplace. Have you noticed that?
Yes, I have. I have. And to go back to what we were talking about before, I think it's been bad for a lot of writers. And I think this kind of thing that you just described, when I talk to a kid about hanging in there and keep on taking physics, and he looks me in the eye and says, "Why? I hate it." He couldn't care less that I'm a reasonably well-known writer. He wants to know what I can do for him lately, and I've got to fight him all the way and perhaps fight his parents, whom he's painted into a corner, because he wants to drop the course. And I know darn well he should stay with it. I like it, and as I said, it works for me. And it was the profession I was trained for, and I like to think I'm pretty good at it.
When you, in your apartment in Manhattan, do you have a special place where you can go and write, where you have some degree of privacy and quiet?
Yes.
How's it set up?
Yeah. We rented two rooms on the floor above a number of years ago, and we could barely afford it, but we did it. And that's the place where I do a lot of writing. Although I've written everywhere, hotel rooms, trains, watching the Mets, libraries, sitting out here waiting for you to come out. I can write anywhere. I'm not one of these guys that is worried about drying up. In fact, my problem is tamping down. Lately, I've been into a couple of sports articles for the Sunday Times, and in fact, I'm working on one right now. It's called Creative Losing.
You're like, kind of like Herbert Gould. He takes that same approach. You heard the broadcast to do with Gould. He says he can write any place, and he doesn't matter if he's flying or riding on a train or sitting in a restaurant, or, you know, he'll take out a pad and paper and scribble.
Gould is a very prolific writer, and I respect much of his work. But I think I think he was trained more in literature and in English than I was. I'm not positive about that, but if I recall,
he went to Columbia.
Yeah, right.
And he studied philosophy, and he was going to write his philosophical dissertation in Paris while riding around the countryside on a bicycle.
Uh-huh.
But he found it dull, and he never finished his PhD, but instead he wrote a novel, which he was able to publish, and went back to Cleveland, where he grew up, and got a job as a hotel clerk, and began writing more things. He didn't sell everything, but a very unusual thing happened to him. He was writing short stories about disc jockeys, and he couldn't sell them. And he wrote a whole batch of stories about disc jockeys, 6, 7, 8 stories. And all of a sudden, Playboy bought one, and they said, "Do you have any more?" And he said, "Yeah." And he sent them all. Playboy bought every one of them.
Mm-hmm. So I think we all have stories like that. Stories that we've written something that gets rejected all over the place. Raw Lion Roar, which is a story of a Puerto Rican kid who falls in love with the Columbia football team and gives his life in the end for the team, literally. I couldn't place that story in New York City. It finally was picked up by the San Francisco Review. And, God, it's been anthologized all over the place, reviewed, in Sunday papers as a single item. So I don't worry too much about rejections generally. If something grabs me, and my best critic, my wife, I'm reasonably satisfied.
I would assume that because we don't have these big general publications, or as many of them anymore, that it's probably hard to make a living as a short story writer exclusively. So many of these stories seem to have to be published in these little magazines that, if they pay anything, they pay very little.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
That's right. I made $25 from the year of the hot jock, which is an O. Henry Award story for next year. On the other hand, the story you talked about, Melanie and the Purple People Eaters, the little kid who spouts sports jargon, the Atlantic printed that, and I made out pretty well and picked up about $900 for it.
Did you read Sermons and Sea Monsters by Paul Theroux in his new book of essays?
No.
Very, very interesting book. He told me that he almost called the book Writing for Money, because these were stories that he had written over a 20-year period. And the assumption is that if you write all these articles and all these stories, you must anthologize them in a real thick book, you must have made a fortune.
Mm-hmm.
So what he wanted to do is, at the beginning of each story, indicate where it was published and how much he made, like such and such a story sold to the Christian Science Monitor, $50,
mm-hmm.
and on and on. And he said that all of the stories, dozens of stories in that anthology, made money like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made less money than over a 20-year period than the vast majority of people make in a year.
Yeah, I've gone through that. A lot of my friends have. And, of course, we all have stories to tell about our relationships with magazines and with editors and the way they want us to change certain things because they know their market and we don't. And sometimes you give in. Generally, you're sorry if you do. Most of the time, you hold the line, and in the end, they'll come around. But I recall having had that experience with the Saturday Evening Post. I had written a story about a social worker who was interacting with a gang of delinquents, plus a student from India. And this is the old Saturday Evening Post that was really printing good stories in those days. Said, we like this, we like it very much, we want to print it, but we want you to do something. We want you to take out the social worker and just keep in the Indian boy. I said, yeah, but the whole story depends on the interaction between the two. I said, look, this is not the Paris Review. 2 million people are going to read this. You're going to get $2,000 for this. We know our business. The little old lady in tennis shoes in Ohio has to understand it, so please listen to us. And again, I sat down with my best critic, and we talked it over. And since I had a job, I could tell them, no, I don't claim to be a hero and that everything I write is golden, but I knew that this was important and this was correct the way it stood, so I said, well, send me back the story, please. And they said, oh, okay, you win. All right, we'll print it. Well, they printed it. I got letters from little old ladies in Ohio who where delinquency exists and where social workers exist. And of course, it just proves that they really don't know as much as they think they do.
I wouldn't have had that amount of courage.
Well, I had it because I have a job and an income. And as I said, I'm not a hero. Probably if I had to depend on this for a living, I might have knuckled under.
Are you a reader, big reader yourself?
You mean of modern stuff? Mm-hmm. Up to a point.
Who are some of the people you like to read?
Well, in the short story, I have to confess that outside of Cheever, perhaps Ray Carver, that I'm not overly impressed by too many people today. Cheever was the master, in my opinion, and since World War II, aside from Salinger's 9 stories, I think Cheever's body of work is just a landmark. The early Roth was tremendous, and I suspect if he had continued to write short stories, he'd be right up there with Chiva, Carver, and Faust. As you can see, I have my share of ego.
Deservedly?
Excuse me?
Deservedly.
Thank you. The longer stuff, I'm afraid, just hasn't knocked me out in recent years. So I go back and read Dickens and William Dean Howells and Edith Wharton, and I'm happy.
Are you so fully entrenched in your job as a in guidance counseling that you would not consider doing a teaching job in creative writing at a college someplace?
I've done it in a number of summers. I've taught the University of Rochester a couple of summers. I've done some lecturing during the school year. On a full-time basis, I don't think so. But who knows? You know, one of these days, I might take a year off and give it a shot.
Sabbatical and teach somewhere. It might be interesting.
It might be.
Seeing what young people are writing about.
It might be. Yeah.
I talked to a lot of writers today, and there's something that strikes me. It's kind of interesting. I always ask them who they like to read, and it's interesting that they don't. They never say Saul Bellow. They don't say William Styron. They don't say John Cheever. They give names like Raymond Carver is hot among young people today. Bobby Ann Mason, Ann Beattie. And I have a feeling that young people who write are very influenced by their peers. They want to know what people their age are writing about and saying, and I think they have a tendency to want to write for people who are very much like them. In many respects,
I agree completely because I work with young people, and this is not only true about young writers. I think that this generation probably, and I have to be careful about making such a sweeping statement, but I would think that this generation is more influenced by the peer group than any time in history. I think they listen to each other more than we ever did, or our forebears ever did. And more than they listen to their parents, obviously. But I think this generation is unique in that they are influenced by each other to that extent, not only writers, but kids who are into anything.
Well, you know, Elmore Leonard was here a while back, and he wrote the introduction in Willie Remembers, and he told me something kind of interesting. He sometimes goes to writing seminars, and his advice to young people is to find a well-established writer, not a new one, but a well-established writer, and imitate, just in the same way that painters imitate, because you just don't start out putting paint on the canvas, and you look for people who set standards, and he thinks that is probably a pretty good way of starting to write, by imitating not your peers, but to imitate people who have made it.
I don't think I'd go that far, and I don't think I agree with him completely. I think there is a facet of what he's saying that I'll buy, and that is I would substitute for the word imitate the phrase get turned on by, because I think there are writers that talk to different people. I'm sure I talk to some people, and I'm sure that Cheever does, and I'm sure that Malamud does, and so on. And if that's the case, and that gets you going, because in the final analysis, it doesn't make any difference how many great books you have in your head. If you don't get it on paper, it doesn't make any difference. So if that can turn the key, fine. And if you're even derivative, that's okay, too. I'm not so sure I buy the imitate aspect. On the other hand, Elmore is a great kidder, so you never know.
He told me something funny. He resents it when people knock at his door and say, I've just written this manuscript, and would you read it and tell me how you like it? He says, you know, if I played the saxophone and I knocked at the musician's door and And he opened up and said, "Hey, I play the saxophone. Can I play for you?" He said, yeah. He would be outraged. He said, he doesn't want to read anybody's manuscript. That ever happened to you? The neighbors say, "Hey, Irv, I've just written this terrific novel here. Will you take a look at it?"
Happens all the time.
Did you take a look at it? If you have to, I guess.
If they're kids in, that I work with or have gone off to college, I will. I kind of hate to do it because one of the things you can do is clobber a young talent, and you have to be very careful about how you handle that. And I guess that's maybe what I could contribute as a teacher of writing, my counseling experience. But when adults ask me, I usually beg off because I know generally that it's not going to talk to me. And if they want to play around and have some fun writing, who am I to discourage them? That's the best thing I can tell them. If you like it, if you enjoy it, go ahead and do it. The problem is with everybody who writes or thinks about writing is they get that little three-letter word into the whole business, EGO, and they're just desperate to see their stuff published. And that's destroyed more young talent and old talent, I guess, than anything else. If you can just relax and let the thing come out. Now, I sound as if I've got this formula down pat. I don't, because as I said before, I have my own share of ego. But when I can keep it under control, as I generally do, and let the work do the work, and let the work itself be the product and the satisfaction, that's when it's really good. And if somebody wants to publish it, great. One of the best books I've ever written has been sitting in my drawer for about 5 years.
Well, Irvin Faust, you're certainly an interesting guy and very easy to talk to. I thought the stories in The Year of the Hotjock were wonderful. They just read as though they had been part of the page and didn't seem as though there was any effort. You know, you can tell when there is a struggling effort to make something work because it doesn't work. But these stories, I think the only story that I didn't like as much, and I'm not sure if I remember the name of it, that was the kind of surrealistic story. Oh, Gary Disdong.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably the one I cared for less than the others. But
you're entitled.
Yeah, that's true. But I thought I thought these stories were so good, and I really appreciate you coming and talking to me about them, and look forward to putting this together and giving Herb Gohl a run for his money on the air.
My pleasure. You're one of the few interviewers who's read everything in the book.
Thank you.